Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.19, The Yildiz Assassination, Armenian Resistance, Part 6. I want to start off today by giving a quick shout-out to Patreon subscriber Houston P. I really appreciate your continued support of the show. It means more than you could ever know. Thank you, Houston, and I look forward to seeing you for pancakes. Okay, and then one quick announcement is that after today, I will be taking a little 2 or maybe 3 week break in order to recalibrate a bit, because we are about to dive headlong into 1908. We are nearly there, folks, so a lot to look forward to when we get back in just a few weeks. And with that, on with the show. By the summer of 1905, Sultan Abdulhamid was approaching his 30th year as the absolute ruler of the Ottoman Empire. And reaching this 30-year milestone would put the 62-year-old Sultan Caliph in an elite club of Ottoman rulers, up there with just a handful of other great sultans such as Suleiman the Magnificent and Mahmud II. And this very long reign had certainly not been some sleepy time in history where things just kind of plodded along. Abdulhamid had governed his realm during potentially the most chaotic period in Ottoman history, as the empire rapidly lost territory to European imperialism, faced countless popular uprisings amongst the empire's religious minorities, and witnessed a dramatic rise in revolutionary conspiracy amongst Muslim bureaucrats and professionals. But through it all, Abdulhamid continued to hold tight to his power through the tried-and-true combination of the old carrot and the stick, handing out favors and offering amnesty to especially influential individuals, while at the same time fiercely repressing sedition and rebelliousness through constructing an elaborate police, initiating mass arrests, and condoning the massacring of entire populations perceived to be generally insurrectionary. But of course, this style of violent autocracy had some major downsides, and moving into the 20th century, Abdulhamid could feel his hold on power beginning to slip through his fingers. The 1903 Ilinden Uprising, which we talked about last week, had forced the Macedonian question into the international spotlight yet again. But Abdulhamid had managed to weasel his way out of yet another diplomatic crisis without having to offer really any real reforms for the Macedonian Christians. And this was because Abdulhamid was very diplomatically savvy at this point, and he knew that the great powers wanted to maintain the status quo in the Balkans more than anything else, meaning that they would not risk a war with the Ottoman Empire at this point. So, through the use of shrewd diplomacy when dealing with the great powers, and through a combination of the old carrot and stick when dealing with his subjects, the Sultan had managed to not only remain in power, but also to prevent his empire from collapsing. And seeing as there were countless forces acting in opposition to his rule both domestically and internationally, this was honestly pretty impressive. But, as we know all too well, Abdulhamid's continuing hold on power had been earned at an appalling human cost, as his subjects had, over the past 30 years, been forced to live under a regime of fierce repression, as thousands of the Sultan's subjects had been arbitrarily arrested, executed, harassed, censored, permanently displaced, and indiscriminately massacred. And the group who consistently bore the brunt of this abuse under Abdulhamid's despotic rule were the Armenians. And today, Abdulhamid's systemic abuse of the Armenian community in the Ottoman Empire will finally catch up with him. Going all the way back to the fall of 1896, in the months directly following the Dashnak takeover of the Imperial Ottoman Bank, amidst the violent chaos of the Hamidian massacres, Armenian revolutionaries had begun to plot their revenge against the Red Sultan. And in the years following the Hamidian massacres, this plot to assassinate Sultan Abdulhamid would become more and more concrete, as agents within the Central Committee of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, the Dashnaks, fiercely argued about the best way in which to seek justice against the Sultan for his direct involvement in the heinous atrocities of 1894 to 1896, in which over 100,000 defenseless civilians were indiscriminately murdered by reactionary mobs with the help of the Sultan's Hamidiye cavalry and the Ottoman Imperial Army and gendarme police. These plans of the Dashnaks to assassinate the Sultan would remain a tightly held secret for many, many years, as the Armenian revolutionaries knew that if the plot were to be uncovered, the Sultan would not hesitate to use mass violence against Armenian civilians in order to suppress such seditious activity. In 1898, 2 years after the Dashnak Bank takeover and the subsequent massacre of Armenians living in Istanbul, the Dashnaks held a general congress in Tiflis, that hub of Armenian life in the Russian Caucasus, in order to discuss the most effective ways in which to continue resisting the Sultan's murderous regime. At this congress, the Dashnaks decided to send more revolutionary fighters and weapons into eastern Anatolia, in order to lay the groundwork for a mass uprising in the area surrounding Lake Van, near the borders of the Russian and Persian empires. The long-term goal for this concentration of Dashnak forces in eastern Anatolia was to initiate a widespread revolt no later than 1905. 3 years after this plan was initiated, a secret meeting was held in April of 1901 in the city of Plovdiv, the capital of eastern Rumelia, which you may remember had united with Bulgaria in 1885 and was also the home of Bulgarian anarchist Mikhail Gerzhikov, who played such a pivotal role in the MRO's revolutionary activities in 1903, as he was the ideological inspiration for the boatmen who were behind the bombing campaign in Salonika, and he would lead the anarchist Stranja Commune during the height of the Ilinden Uprising, or at least as much as one can be said to lead an anarchist commune. And well, Plovdiv was not a terribly big place, so Armenian revolutionaries and Macedo-Bulgarian revolutionaries very much colluded and worked together to resist Hamidian despotism. And in fact, Dashnak founder Christopher Mikhailian had helped teach Gotsadelchev how to effectively construct bombs when the MRO leader was working on building a bomb factory on the Bulgarian border. And as we are about to see, Christopher Mikhailian had become quite good at making bombs over these past few years. And the Armenian Mikhailian, much like the two Macedonians, Delchev and Gerzhikov, had also become increasingly influenced by anarchist ideology. So, at this meeting held in April of 1901 in the city of Plovdiv, this little hub of Balkan anarchism, the Dashnaks officially committed themselves to carrying out the assassination of Sultan Abdulhamid. This plot would be organized by a secret committee under the leadership of Dashnak founder Christopher Mikhailian. Now, the last time we talked about Christopher Mikhailian was when he took his little revolutionary group in Tiflis, Young Armenia, and transformed it into the nucleus for the Armenian Revolutionary Federation. And in the decade after he founded the party, Mikhailian had remained one of the most indispensable leaders for the Dashnaks. So, in early 1904, the Dashnaks would hold another general congress, this time in the Bulgarian capital of Sofia. And at this congress, Mikhailian and his comrades laid out an elaborate plan to launch a widespread offensive against Abdulhamid's regime through a combination of anarchist terrorist operations carried out by a secret cell of revolutionaries in Istanbul, and they would couple these anarchist attacks with a large-scale guerrilla war that would be carried out by Fedayi in eastern Anatolia. These simultaneous attacks were meant to prompt a general insurrection that would topple the Sultan's despotic regime and hopefully force, now say it with me everyone, the intervention of a great power. And in fact, the Dashnaks were intentionally modeling their two-pronged attack off of the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-78, which had led to the liberation of the Balkan nation-states, and which had succeeded through an attack on the Ottoman Empire on two fronts, with one assault on Istanbul and the Turkish Straits, and another out in eastern Anatolia. So, the intervention of a great power, preferably Russia, was an essential component of the Dashnak operation from the very beginning. So, during this congress in early 1904, it was agreed that these anarchist attacks and guerrilla uprisings would be launched no later than 1905. And though it was discussed in coded language in order to keep their plans a secret, a central part of this operation was the assassination of Sultan Abdulhamid. Unfortunately for the Dashnaks, events would quickly take on a life of their own in the spring of 1904, And in classic fashion, the Armenian revolutionaries would be forced to scramble, even though they had been carefully laying their plans for nearly a decade at this point. In the years following the Dashnak's 1898 General Congress in Tiflis, when the party committed themselves to laying the groundwork for a future mass uprising, the Dashnak Federation had built up a pretty impressive contingent of fedayi in eastern Anatolia. These Dashnak fedayi were always pretty limited in their overall numbers, but they had become quite effective at protecting Armenian villages from Kurdish bandits and at harassing Ottoman authorities. And this effectiveness largely stemmed from the intense loyalty and discipline of the Dashnak recruits. And I probably should have mentioned this earlier, but the word fedayi is derived from an Arabic word meaning those who sacrifice. And indeed, these revolutionaries were all self-sacrificing volunteers who were usually fully prepared to die for the sake of their people's liberation. So, even though their numbers were never very large, the Dashnak fedayi represented a real force to be reckoned with in eastern Anatolia, and they would be a constant thorn in the side of Sultan Abdulhamid and his government. In the months leading up to their General Congress of 1904, the Dashnaks had greatly accelerated their concentration of forces in the area surrounding Lake Van, because, as we just said, a big part of their overall plan for 1905 was to launch a widespread revolt in eastern Anatolia, at the same time that anarchist attacks were to be perpetrated in Istanbul. And well, this dramatic increase of Dashnak forces in eastern Anatolia became quite alarming for the Ottoman gendarme police. So, while the Dashnak leadership was meeting in Sofia and laying their plans for a two-pronged attack against Abdulhamid, the Sultan would end up striking first as he launched a counterinsurgency against the fedayi operating out in eastern Anatolia. This counterinsurgency would see the Ottoman Fourth Army muster over 10,000 troops who were sent to eastern Anatolia specifically to prevent the further influx of more Dashnak fighters into the region. And well, this action would end up forcing the fedayi to engage with the Ottoman army long before all the necessary preparations had been laid. And so, a dynamic somewhat similar to what we saw in the Linden Uprising last week would play out, as this Armenian uprising also had to be launched prematurely. And so, as had happened over in Macedonia, the sheer reality of the numbers meant that the Dashnak fedayi never really stood a chance against the Ottoman army. But even so, the Dashnak fedayi were a very determined and well-disciplined group. So what followed was a classic guerrilla campaign in which only a few thousand Armenian fedayi used hit-and-run tactics and their knowledge of the local terrain to harass the much larger combined force of Ottoman soldiers and Kurdish irregulars. Armenian guerrilla bands fought several dramatic battles against Ottoman forces, and these guerrillas managed to drag the conflict on for over a month as they consistently managed to escape through the Ottoman lines and to evade capture by dispersing out into the mountains. But as we have seen time and time again, this uprising would be brought to a brutal end when Ottoman forces, together with Kurdish irregulars and the Hamidiye cavalry, began indiscriminately massacring the civilian population and burning and looting Armenian villages. Now, thankfully, this violence would for the most part be contained to a small region in eastern Anatolia. So this would not be a repeat of the Hamidian massacres. But nonetheless, just a year after the Ilinden Uprising had been suppressed in Macedonia and southern Thrace, yet another mass uprising had erupted amongst Ottoman Christians, this time in eastern Anatolia. And yet again, the Sultan and his government had resorted to the use of mass violence in order to suppress this unrest. While this uprising was breaking out in March of 1904, the Central Committee of the Dashnak Federation had been holding their General Congress in Sofia, in which they were carefully laying plans to simultaneously initiate anarchist terrorist attacks in Istanbul and to launch a mass uprising in eastern Anatolia. And well, the counterinsurgency of the Ottomans had forced the fedayi to play defense and so had eliminated half of this overall plan, because the Fedayi in eastern Anatolia would be crushed, and it would now take years for them to rebuild their forces. But even with this major setback, the Dashnaks would resolve to simply carry on with half of their original plan, and they would begin laying the groundwork for anarchist measures to be taken against the Ottoman administration in Istanbul. Following the General Congress in Sofia, these planned attacks against the Ottoman regime would begin to coalesce around Christopher Michalian's conspiracy to assassinate Sultan Abdulhamid. This operation would come to be known as Operation Nejuik, which I think I'm saying that right, but Nejuik means something like a purebred horse, which was the Dashnak's code name for Sultan Abdulhamid. Now, because the Sultan's secret police were everywhere in Istanbul, Operation Nejuik would end up being an incredibly complex affair involving many different people from many different backgrounds. And essentially, Michalian developed a wide network of separate revolutionary cells that would end up involving around 30 individuals. The first of these cells was a central committee led by Christopher Michalian, which would act as the brain of the operation. Michalian's central commando would include six members, with one of the most important of these members being a young 23-year-old woman named Sophie Arishian, though Arishian would become better known by her revolutionary pseudonym, Rubina. And in fact, all of the conspirators would adopt fake identities to help them keep a low profile in Istanbul. Christopher Michalian went by Samuel Fain, and Arishian was meant to pass as Michalian's daughter, Rubina Fain. Moving outward from this nucleus of the operation led by Michalian and Rubina, there were two cells in the Balkans, one of which was meant to coordinate with Macedonian revolutionaries in Bulgaria, including Boris Sarafov, and then another cell was stationed along the western Anatolian coast in the city of Smyrna, today known as Izmir in Turkey. This group was meant to launch an attack in Smyrna simultaneous with the assassination. And then the Dashnaks also hired two European chemistry professors who were experts in explosives, one of whom lived in Geneva and another lived in Paris. And then finally, there was a cell in Istanbul, which was meant to act as a support group for the central commando surrounding Michalian and Rubina. So, like we said, this network would include around 30 people in total, but in order to maintain strict secrecy, the identity of each individual cell was intentionally unknown to all the other cells, a measure that was meant to protect the group in case of possible arrest or betrayal of a single member. Okay, now that we have the basic skeleton of the operation down, we come to one of the more fascinating members of this entire operation, a man who would capture the imagination of the European public following the assassination attempt and help the Dashnak stunt to make front-page news all across Western Europe. And this was the Belgian anarchist Edward Joris. Edward Joris had been involved in radical left-wing politics ever since he was a teenager. As a youngster growing up in Belgium, Joris had worked as a secretary for the Belgian Workers' Party, and he had become involved with local unions. Early on, Joris proved himself to be a talented journalist and a committed anarchist, as he became a regular contributor to anarchist newspapers, writing articles defending anarcho-syndicalism, which, yeah, that's a pretty fancy-sounding word, but to way oversimplify, anarcho-syndicalism is a branch of anarchism that essentially sees labor unions as a potential way in which to structure all of society. The idea here being that society could be transformed through a series of workers' strikes, and as workers gain more and more power through these cooperative efforts, the need for a government or for capitalist owners would eventually just wither away, as a more equitable society is built through a broad network of labor organizations. This would allow society to move past both capitalist exploitation and state power. So, since he was a teenager, Edward Joris had been both a committed anarchist and a labor activist. In 1901, when Joris was 25 years old, he decided to move to Istanbul to look for work, and he would land a job at a sewing machine company. and shortly thereafter, Joris would be joined by his wife, a woman named Anna Nellens, who was also a fiercely committed anarchist and who had come to be better known by her revolutionary nom de guerre, Bella. After they arrived in the Ottoman Empire, Edward Joris and his wife, Bella, naturally took an interest in the Armenian cause as left-wing activists who were just generally sympathetic to the plight of all oppressed peoples. But it was a matter of sheer coincidence that Joris would share an office at the sewing company where he worked with a member of Christopher McCallion's Central Commando in Istanbul, a man named Kenderian. So when this Armenian revolutionary realized that he was working alongside a radical anarchist, he decided that it was worth taking a risk to see if he might be able to bring Joris into their conspiracy. Now, there were a lot of reasons why it might make sense to try and recruit Edward Joris and his wife Bella into their ranks. To begin with, as Belgian nationals, Joris and Bella were under the protection of the Belgian consul. So they enjoyed certain privileges, such as an increased freedom of movement throughout the empire. Additionally, the Dashnaks knew that if they could get a Western European on board with their plan, then the great powers might be more likely to pay attention because their actions would not be seen as purely partisan, but instead as more broadly humanitarian. This non-partisan angle was further supported by the fact that Joris and Bella were Belgian, and Belgium was a non-alignment state. This fact would allow the Dashnaks to more easily deflect accusations that they were representing the foreign interests of the British or the Russians. So, for all these reasons, Kenderian decided to take a leap of faith, and he would recruit Joris and Bella into their conspiracy. And once these Belgian anarchists were both on board, they quickly became critical to the overall operation. In the fall of 1904, Edward Joris and Bella opened up one of their bedrooms in their Istanbul apartment to Christopher McCallion and Rubina, who had both managed to enter the Ottoman Empire using their secret identities. So, McCallion, Rubina, Joris, Bella, and others in the Central Commando would spend their days scouting out Yildiz Palace and planning their operation. During these planning sessions, two primary approaches were discussed. The first plan was put forward by McCallion, and this plan bore the clear influence of People's Will, which was the populist Russian revolutionary group that had successfully assassinated Tsar Alexander II in 1881. And you may remember that when McCallion was a young student living in Moscow, he had become a member of People's Will. So McCallion would essentially argue that the Dashnaks should just copy People's Will and use their assassination strategy, which boiled down to just sneaking someone into an imperial ceremony and having them hurl a bunch of bombs at the feet of the sovereign. The second plan was put forward by one of McCallion's closest comrades, a longtime Dashnak named Sappho, who would argue that it would actually be much easier to assassinate Abdulhamid during one of the Sultan's weekly visits to the Hamidiye Mosque. In his plan, the Dashnak Sappho actually came up with a very innovative approach to the assassination, an approach that would go on to be quite important for the future of 20th century terrorism. And that innovation was the car bomb. Sappho proposed that the Dashnaks should purchase a large carriage, load this carriage with tons of explosives, and then park it near the Yildiz Mosque. Then, a Dashnak agent could wait until the Sultan was approaching said carriage, ignite the fuse, run away, and then this carriage would blow up everything around it. And if the timing was just right, Sultan Abdulhamid would be blown up along with everything else in the direct vicinity. As we'll see, the Dashnaks would eventually go with Sappho's plan to use a carriage loaded with explosives. And from what I can tell, the Yildiz bombing marks the first recorded use of a car bomb in history, as the Dashnak stunt would occur 15 years before the much more famous Wall Street bombing, in which an Italian anarchist loaded a horse-drawn carriage and blew it up outside of J.P. Morgan in 1920. But, you know, historical firsts are always a bit tricky, so if anyone knows of an earlier use of the car bomb, I would love to hear about it. So, after scouting out the Yildiz Mosque, the Dashnak Central Commando marked July 21st, 1905, as the date when they would carry out the assassination. And they then began to make all the necessary preparations. Sappho and the two Belgian anarchists, Edward Joris and Bella, stayed behind in the Ottoman capital. Sappho would organize the purchase of a large carriage, and Joris helped to smuggle in explosive materials, which were packaged as bars of soap. These explosive soap bars passed customs and then were hidden in the cellar of the Belgians' Istanbul home. Meanwhile, Mikaelian, Rubina, and Kenderian left Istanbul for Bulgaria in order to further experiment with explosives. And it would be during this preparatory phase that tragedy would strike the Dashnaks and throw their plan into sudden disarray. Mikaelian and Kenderian were out on the outskirts of Sofia testing their explosives on the slopes of Mount Vitosha when they accidentally discharged one of their bombs prematurely. This accidental explosion would kill both of the Dashnaks on March 17, 1905. Just a few months before the assassination was meant to take place. The death of Christopher Mikaelian, the original founder and longtime leader of the Dashnaks, would create a bit of an existential crisis for the Armenian Federation. And to give you an idea of Mikaelian's influence, his funeral, which was held in Sofia, was attended by no less than 6,000 people, including not only Armenians, but also some Macedonian revolutionaries and even some sympathetic Turkish students. So, the death of Christopher Mikaelian was a major blow for the Dashnaks, and for a time it was not clear whether the assassination plot would be carried out at all. However, it was at this point that Sappho, the Dashnak who had come up with the car bomb innovation, would take over the leadership of the Central Commando. And when Sappho traveled to Geneva to meet with the Dashnak Central Committee, he successfully convinced them that the plan should still move forward. After the deaths of Mikaelian and Kenderian, the Central Commando in Istanbul would now only include four individuals: Sappho, Rubina, and the two Belgian anarchists, Edward Joris and Bella. As July 21st approached, disagreements would begin to arise between Rubina, who had in many ways been the second in command under Mikaelian before his untimely death, and Sappho, who was now trying to take over leadership of the operation. This rivalry between Rubina and Sappho would come to a head when both Dashnaks expressed their deep desire to be the one who got to detonate the bomb, which, you know, kind of gives you an idea of where these people are at. They were literally begging to be the one allowed to detonate a car bomb. The two would not be able to come to any agreement, so the conspirators decided to draw a name out of a hat. And when Rubina's name was the one drawn, she is said to have been overcome with joy. On the morning of July 21st, 1905, Edward Joris went to see off Sappho and Rubina and to wish them luck. And when he found that the Dashnaks were feeling understandably hesitant, he allegedly said to them, "If you don't go, I'll go alone." And with this encouragement from the Belgian anarchists, the revolutionaries climbed aboard their shiny new carriage, which was packed full of explosives, and drove it down to the Yildiz complex, parking it right next to the Hamidiye Mosque at 10 a.m. Then, at 12 o'clock noon, Sultan Abdulhamid appeared with his imperial retinue and was welcomed by a cheering crowd as he entered the mosque for his Friday prayers. Then, at 12:43, Rubina spotted the Sultan at the entrance of the mosque, chatting with an important religious scholar. This was their sign that the Sultan was about to make his exit. So, Rubina armed the explosives, set the timers, and scurried away down the road. About a minute and a half later, just before 12:45 p.m., a massive explosion decimated the courtyard outside of the Hamidiye Mosque, creating a small crater 10 feet wide and 2 feet deep. This explosion immediately drew the attention of the residents of Istanbul, as the blast is said to have been heard over 10 miles away. Edward Joris, who was working at his office at the sewing company, likely for the sake of having an alibi, heard the explosion just before his lunch break. After they had successfully avoided the police following the explosion, Rubina and Safo hustled down to the train station where they waited for Edward Joris and Bella, who were supposed to meet them. However, the Belgian couple never showed, and after a few hours, the Dashnaks decided they could wait no longer, and they climbed aboard an 8 p.m. train bound for Vienna. As the train pulled out of the station, the Armenian revolutionaries and former rivals allegedly held hands and let out a collective sigh of relief. They were alive, and the Sultan was dead. Justice had finally been achieved for the hundreds of thousands of victims, their fellow countrymen, who had been needlessly slaughtered 10 years earlier during the Hamidian massacres. They had pulled it off. A new Sultan would be anointed. The attention of the great powers would be attracted. And maybe, just maybe, things would finally begin to change for the Armenians of the Ottoman Empire, who had been suffering for over a decade under a murderous regime hostile to their people. But the next day, when Rubina and Safo stopped in Sofia, they received devastating news. For no particular reason, Sultan Abdulhamid had briefly paused on the steps of the Hamidiye Mosque. And this delay, which amounted to no more than just a few seconds, had saved Abdulhamid's life as the bomb had exploded before he was in the blast zone. So the Red Sultan had come away unscathed. Now, that is not to say that there were no casualties from this attack. Quite to the contrary. 26 people had died, 58 were seriously wounded, and 55 horses were killed as well. Most of the victims were members of the imperial retinue, either soldiers or coach drivers. So the carnage was immense, but the Dashnaks had failed in their primary objective. Abdulhamid was very much alive and very much still the Sultan. Then, when Rubina and Safo finally reached Geneva and joined back up with their fellow Dashnaks, they received yet more terrible news. On July 27th, 6 days after the attack, Edward Joris had been arrested by the Ottoman police. Shortly after the Yildiz bombing, the Dashnak Central Committee had mailed an official declaration to the Russian, Austrian, and French embassies, openly taking responsibility for the attack. However, because a Belgian national had just been arrested, the European powers essentially refused to believe that this attack had been carried out by Armenian revolutionaries. In the days immediately following the bombing, most people thought that this declaration from the Dashnaks was a mere diversion, and that the letter had been a forgery put together by the real perpetrators. Most thought that this was likely the doing of a Macedonian or Bulgarian revolutionary group, like the MRO or the Boatmen. Others blamed international anarchist groups, and some thought that it might have been the Young Turks, or even that it was an internal plot undertaken by palace conspirators. With the memory of the Hamidian massacres still fresh in everyone's mind, Europeans were very slow to blame Armenian revolutionaries. After the arrest of Edward Joris, and after a very thorough investigation, the Ottoman authorities were able to piece together what had happened, and they pretty quickly had a comprehensive list of all the people who had been involved. So, they promptly arrested the perpetrators who remained in the Ottoman Empire. Because Edward Joris was a Belgian national, the Yildiz bombing would become a sensational event in the European press, and it would come to be referred to many in the press as the Joris Affair. In the days immediately following the event, the international press had loudly denounced the assassination attempt as a monstrous attack on one of the globe's ruling sovereigns. However, the involvement of Joris would have the effect of softening the hearts of people living in Europe. This shift in European public opinion would begin in Belgium as journalists, lawyers, and other citizens defending the cause of human rights began to express their solidarity with their fellow countryman, Edward Joris, and people began to call for the anarchists to be released. And so, in true turn-of-the-century style, people began forming little support communities to argue the case for why Joris should be released by the Ottoman authorities. And their argument was essentially that Joris should be tried in Belgium. and that because Belgian nationals enjoyed certain privileges in the Ottoman Empire due to a previously negotiated treaty between Belgium and the Ottomans, that Joris had the right to leave the empire to be judged in his home country. This movement would spread to other neighboring countries in Europe, and so Joris became an international cause célèbre. And a lot of people at the time compared the public denunciation of Joris's arrest with the Dreyfus Affair, also happening in France around this same time. However, even with the outcry of support for the Belgian anarchists, the Ottomans decided to go ahead with the trial, which would begin in late November 1905. Alongside Edward Joris, 16 other people were also tried, and this group included 10 Armenians. All of these suspects faced death sentences for their involvement in the assassination attempt. During the course of the trial, the eloquent Edward Joris would use his time in the international spotlight to loudly condemn Sultan Abdülhamid's government and to offer his support for the Armenian cause. So, this public trial would be a bit of a PR coup for the Armenian revolutionaries, as European public opinion was fixated once more on the Armenian question, and most were sympathetic to the plight of Ottoman Armenians. This sensational trial would drag on for about a month. But finally, on December 18th, Edward Joris and three other Armenians were sentenced to death. The rest of the group was sentenced to either life in prison or to a shorter sentence based on their relative involvement in the conspiracy. Edward Joris would languish in an Ottoman prison for the next 2 years. However, in circumstances that still to this day remain somewhat mysterious, the Belgian anarchist was suddenly released on Christmas Day, December 25th, 1907. The official reason offered by the Ottoman government was that Abdülhamid, the always merciful sultan, had decided to show clemency for Joris, as the Belgian's health had begun to decline in recent months. And so, Edward Joris would be allowed to return home to Belgium, and he would live for another 50 years, dying in 1957. There has been a lot of speculation as to why Abdülhamid decided to release Edward Joris when he did. And like we have said, the real reason for the Belgians' release remains somewhat obscure to this day. However, one of the more convincing theories points to the fact that Joris was released at the exact same time that the Second Congress of the Ottoman Opposition was meeting in Paris in December 1907. And as had been the case with the First Congress, also held in Paris in 1902, the most prominent delegates at this second Congress would be drawn from the Young Turks and from the Armenian revolutionaries in the Dashnak Federation. But why, you might ask, would the sudden release of Edward Joris matter for this second Congress of the Ottoman opposition? Well, the answer to that question lies in the response of the Young Turks to this attempted assassination of Abdülhamid. Immediately following the Yıldız bombing in 1905, leaders of the Young Turks, the most prominent being Ahmed Rıza, loudly denounced the attempt to assassinate Abdülhamid. Essentially, Ahmed Rıza and others argued that non-Turks should not be meddling in Ottoman affairs. Basically, they said that if someone were going to assassinate the Sultan, it needed to be a Turkish-speaking Muslim and not a Belgian anarchist or an Armenian from the Russian Empire. So, it has been argued that the always adroit Sultan Abdülhamid had decided to release Edward Joris as the Second Congress of the Ottoman Opposition was being held in 1907 in order to sow discord between the Young Turks and the Armenian Dashnaks, who were trying their best to put aside their differences so that they could dethrone Abdülhamid once and for all. But, as we will see, this Congress held in December of 1907 would put all of the pieces in place for the Revolution of 1908, which would occur just a few months later. So, we are nearing the big day, boys and girls, and next episode we will be introducing possibly the two most important figures of this entire series, in terms of their influence on the future course of the Ottoman Empire, the Republic of Turkey, and the other nations that will be born from the ashes of the Ottoman collapse. And those two people are Talat Pasha, and Mustafa Kemal, the future Ataturk. In the years following 1908, Talat Pasha will manage to establish near-complete dictatorial rule over the Ottoman Empire, and he will see the empire through to its final days. And after the Ottoman Sultanate and Caliphate has finally fallen, Mustafa Kemal will pick up the pieces left behind by Talat Pasha as he constructs a Republic of Turks out of the ashes of the 600-year-old Ottoman Empire. Both of these men would enter into the political scene in 1906, the year following the Yıldız bombing, as founding members of the Ottoman Freedom Society. This group, under the leadership of Talat Pasha, would finally connect the Young Turks of the CUP operating in exile, specifically Ahmed Reza and Dr. Nazım, with the revolutionary officers in the Ottoman Third Army, in Verbey, Aben Niyazi, and Mustafa Kemal. And in so doing, they would forever change the course of history and set the Ottoman Empire on the path to revolution. Like I said, I will be taking a short break to recalibrate, but once we come back, it will be all downhill to 1908. So join me next time as we finally introduce Talat Pasha as the founder of the Ottoman Freedom Society.